Yeah, this is worth the trip up here just to hear that last bit. I'm Jerry Jones. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's January 1, 1973. Got that right. We have trouble as we age. There were three Al-Anon ladies talking. They were a little age on them, and one of them said to the other, said, "You know, I'm having trouble with my memory. I find myself on the edge of the bed, sitting on the bed, and I can't remember whether I'm getting in or getting out." The other said, "Well, isn't that remarkable? I have the same problem with my car. I find myself in the driveway in the car. I don't know whether I'm going somewhere or whether I just got back." And the other one said, "Well, I feel sorry for you ladies. Knock on wood. Come in." Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm from Texas. Actually, I'm not from Dallas, Texas. My wife has got the house in Dallas, Texas, and I got a little place down on a lake where it's called Whitney, Texas, AA capital of the world. We have a sign that says that in our club room. Humility is our most important item. We practice alcoholism down there. I'm also a lawyer. Some of you will leave now, but that's all right. I hope you don't get a lawyer when you need one. That's what I hope. If you don't like lawyers. I have got 11 years of non-legal practice since I retired. I haven't signed a bill, took any money from anybody for advice, tried any lawsuits. It's just been wonderful. I'm almost normal again. Almost. Alcoholism. Alcoholism is a disease, the book says. It's made up of two parts. A physical craving once we start to drink, which in my case was manifest by the fact when I took a drink, right away, the thought came in my mind, I think I'll have another one of those. And every time I had a drink, I had that same thought until I couldn't think anymore, and then they'd take me home or put me in jail or wherever it went. But when I started, I couldn't stop. And that happened very quick after I started drinking. I never thought about it because I never really wanted to stop. It never occurred to me that anybody would want to stop once you started drinking. I don't know what you would do with two beers, but some people seem to like that sort of thing. The other part is an obsession. You know what an obsession is? That's a great big thought. It's so big, it pushes all the other thoughts out of your mind. And it says, a drink would improve this situation. And you have the drink, and then the craving takes over, and you're back in the deal again. Our book tells us that the main problem of alcoholics centers in their mind. Centers in their mind. Because if we had some mental ability to resist the alcohol, the obsession part, we wouldn't take the first drink. You don't have to be very smart to look back on your drinking career and recognize there are a couple things you wouldn't have done if you hadn't had a couple of drinks. The book says we like the effect of alcohol. Oh, God, yes. Did I like the effect of alcohol? It was wonderful substance. It released any inhibitions which I might have. I didn't have many, but they all went away when I had a few drinks. And if it came in my mind, it was something I did. And I think that's true of a lot of us. It releases us from some inhibitions which we have. It releases us from some fears that we have. You hear people talk about they couldn't dance until they had a drink. And you get drunk, you don't care whether you can dance or not, you're going to do it. And the fact must be then that we have alcoholic minds. Heard a guy down in California talking one time, and he said he had an alcoholic mind. He said if his mind would have killed his body, except he needed it for transportation. My alcoholic mind was very busy. Very, very busy. And it enjoyed the slowing down that takes place when I have a few drinks. The ease and comfort of a few drinks. It was nice. But of course I drank right through that and went on to other things. If the alcoholic's problem centers in his mind, his solution must also center in the mind. A pigeon of mine down in Texas says he goes to thinking school. Thinking school is AA for him. He's learning a new way to think and react to life. They used to have signs in club rooms that said, think, think, think. Yeah. Smart people took those down because they didn't think the alcoholic should do that. But you got to use this screwed up computer to recover from the disease of alcohol. You got to think. You got to embrace a new way of life. And your stories, when you talk about them, is what that old way of life was, what happened to you, and what the new life has brought to you. I was a kid out in a farm in West Texas when I was 10 years old. World War II started, and all the able-bodied men went to war. Old crippled men like my father, and kids 10 years old like me, we were farmers. We did the work of man. I started driving a tractor when I was 10 years old. And I drove tractor 10 or 12 hours a day when I was about 10 years old. And I had a lot of responsibility. My father's name was Clarence L. Jones. Clarence L. Jones had rigid rules. You were responsible for following the damn rules. And it was not a pleasant thing if you didn't follow the rules. And he would, I was loaded up with this responsibility. I had to do it just right. And I discovered a cure for over-responsibility. It's irresponsibility. What you do when you get off the damn tractor and go to town or anywhere else you can get to, you just let the good times roll. You become a lover and a fighter and a wild horse rider and a right smart of a windmill hand too. You don't give a damn whether school keeps or not. You don't want anybody to think you give a damn. You just do whatever's fun and wild and crazy. Well, alcohol fit that pretty good. Helped it out, as a matter of fact. And I went off to college and majored, my wife says I majored in basket weaving. I don't remember those classes, but I didn't go to class a lot, so I don't remember what it was. She was good, though. Met my wife in college, Billy. Billy was a good-looking girl from California, and I was very interested in her right away the first time I saw her, and I still remember the first time I saw her. I thought, that's okay, that's for me. I'm going to, yeah. And as the Bible would say of me, she would have nothing. She recognized right away this guy has a drinking problem, but she needed a car sometimes, and I had a car. And she would loan me her car, and in exchange for that, she would loan me her notes. So when you're not going to class and you sell your books the first day you get them, notes are handy when they're taking tests. So we got through school doing that. Me drinking, partying, doing things I would not have done if I hadn't been drinking. Lots of things I wouldn't have done. But you just drink again the next day and everybody knows you're kind of wild and crazy and you get a reputation for that and you kind of like that reputation. And then somewhere along the line, alcohol begins to turn on you. I really love to drink. I mean, in the beginning, it freed me up. It just set me free. I could get excited about getting drunk a week from tonight. Damn, it's going to be good. We're going to pool our money. We're going to find somebody to buy us some booze, put some gasoline in a car, somebody's car. And hell, there's no telling what we'll do or where we'll be the next morning. And there wasn't. Our first question the next morning often was, where in the hell are we? And then what did we do? And nobody really knew. We had to piece it together. One guy would remember a little snippet over here, and then somebody, and we'd put it together. And then, but I was always the guy that said, "Let's do it again. Let's do her again. What do you think, huh?" Well, I came back through school after I went to the Navy after I got out of school, went to Officers Candidate School, and came back through wearing my uniform, looking pretty dapper. And Billy thought I'd grown up, so she began to tolerate me a little more, and we ultimately wound up getting married. Went to law school after I got out of the service, and she thought I was not going to drink after I got married. That's what Clarence did. I didn't do what Clarence did. I didn't see any reason to give that up at all. I liked it. And I certainly never told her that I was going to quit drinking when we got married. Never crossed my mind. Anyway, wound up in Dallas practicing law. And I liked it. I liked practicing law. I was a competitor. I tried office practice for a little while where you draft deeds and wills and stuff like that. But you can't win a deed or anything like that. Hell, there's no competition there. I wanted to be a player, and before you do that is a courtroom. So I became a trial lawyer. You can tell whether you're winning or losing in the courtroom. Fact of the matter is you really aren't winning or losing. You don't make the facts. You don't... You don't make the law. You judge and decide the law. There's all kinds of things going on that you don't have any part of, except you're just trying to present your client's case. But I didn't know that. I thought I was winning or I was losing. And I could lose a little bitty lawsuit, and I remember them all. Every loss I think I ever had, I remember. I remember the lawyer on the other side, that son of a bitch. And the witnesses who were... just let me down terribly and all this kind of stuff, you know. Remember all those things. The winning, I don't remember much about the cases I won. That's just what it was supposed to be. So I rocked along, and the pressure of trying lawsuits and feeling like you need to win all of them begins to build on you. And you need a little relaxation, a little comfort to get away from things. And I needed comfort. And alcohol gave me that. Alcohol continued to let me back away from life a little bit. It seemed to chemically alter reality. Just change the way things look. They could look pretty rotten, but I could have a few drinks, and by God, they begin to look better. And so I used it pretty regularly. I used it a lot. Billy didn't drink. This presented a subject for communication in our firm and our family pretty often, almost daily. I realized finally that my wife had some kind of a psychological barrier against use of alcohol. So by God, I sent her to a psychiatrist to straighten this thing out. And to show you how sick she was, she went. He sent for me in a little while, but we didn't have much in common, didn't have much to talk about, and I didn't go anymore. But she wouldn't quit. She wouldn't quit. She sent off for tests to take to see whether you were alcoholic or not alcoholic. I got the damn test. I'm good at taking tests. I read all the questions first, and I figured I know how you're supposed to answer each one of them. If you don't want to be an alcoholic, it's pretty obvious. Do you ever drink with anybody? I'll drink alone. Well, the true answer was hell yes. Nobody will drink with me. My wife won't drink. But, you know, you say that you don't do that. And so I came out not pure and clean, but I came out as a heavy drinker, which was quite all right with me. That was just where I wanted to wind up. And Billy kept after me. And then she did something that was really pretty extraordinary. She went to this thing called Al-Anon. Are there any of those people here tonight? She didn't ask me if she could go to Al-Anon. She didn't tell me she was going to Al-Anon. One night I asked my little daughter, "Where is your mother?" I didn't much care where she was except when I needed something, and I wanted her right there, right then. So I said, "Where's your mother?" And she said, "I don't know, Daddy." I said, "Where is your mother?" She said, "I don't know, Daddy. She may be at one of those meetings." "What kind of a meeting?" "A family meeting, I think, Daddy." At this point in time, my wife and I had agreed that we were just not getting along. We couldn't agree on money. We couldn't agree on alcohol. We were having a lot of problems. We both loved our kids. We loved each other, I think, but our life was just complete chaos most of the time. And it occurred to me, we'd agreed that in 6 months, if it didn't get any better, we were going to get a divorce. And it occurred to me when my daughter said that family meeting my wife might be going to, under these conditions, probably I ought to have a representative at that meeting. Certainly, I needed to know what in the hell was going on. So she came in, and I said, "Where have you been?" My wife is one of the most difficult women I've ever, or most difficult people I've ever cross-examined. I'm good at cross-examination. Her answer was, "Out." She will not lie to you, but by God, getting information from her when she's in this mood is just like trying to hit a snake with an ice pick. It's really hard to do. You know? She said she had been out, and I said, "Out where?" "To Preston Center shopping." "What were you shopping for?" "I was there for a meeting." "Oh, what kind of a meeting was it?" "Just some people, that some friends of mine." "Who are your friends? Who are you?" "Wouldn't know them." Okay, it's going to be that kind of night. So you start asking questions and narrowing the field. Finally, I got this word, Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What would be an Al-Anon? I'd never heard the word before. And by this time, our conversation had become a little heated. I didn't want to appear ignorant, so I made my best guess. I thought it must be some form of aluminum kitchen utensil. It wasn't. She suddenly became very talkative. She began to tell me what a wonderful organization Al-Anon was. How people would pay $500 a seat just to go to Al-Anon meetings if they just knew how good it was. Everybody was welcome at an Al-Anon meeting. They were loving, they were kind, considerate. It was just a marvelous place to go, and everybody was welcome. Everybody was welcome. And the only requirement for membership was that you have a family member or friend who has a problem with alcohol. Oh, you've taken my alleged problem with alcohol to a public meeting. I just made partner in the largest law firm in Dallas. I don't need any adverse publicity at all. That we already got two alcoholic lawyers there. I know. I've heard them talk about them. I know what they're going to do with them. They're going to get rid of them just as quick as they can. And I've just got my foot in the door. I haven't got any power there. And my wife is going to public meetings talking about my problem with alcohol. I know that's what she's doing. Sure as hell, that's what she's doing. I said to her, said, sit down, sit down. I need to talk to you. I sobered up almost immediately. I said, Billy, do you know that I'm the only one who brings any money to this house? Yeah, she knew that. I said, do you understand we owe money on our furniture, on our cars, on the house itself? We owe money to damn near everybody. Do you know what happens when you don't pay those bills each month? What happens? They come and get those things. They take them away. If that firm downtown finds out that you're going to a meeting thinking I'm an alcoholic and publicly professing that, they're going to fire me the next day. We're not talking about money for college educations for our kids. We're not talking about that. We're talking about standing naked on the streets of Dallas in the middle of the damn winter. Do you understand? You must not go to those damn meetings. And fear went through me like a shot, you know. God, what a dumb thing to do. She said, I think I need to go. I said, Billy, please do not go to any more of those meetings. She said, I believe, Jerry, that I'm going to go. They get their hands on one of them for just a little while. It's just really hard to get them out of there, I'll tell you. So I recognized I better put a little more pressure on. So I said, if I find out you've been to another one of them damn meetings, I'll kill you this sure as hell. She said, I'm going. And she did, and I didn't kill her. But she drove me crazy. Every day I went to work, I was thinking, my God, will they call me in today and fire me? I understand your wife thinks you're an alcoholic. Tell us about that, Jerry. And I'd get through that day and nobody'd say anything. And I'd drive home, and on the way home, and I was thinking, I've got to get that woman out of Al-Anon. There's got to be some way. I tried everything. I begged. I pleaded. I threatened. Nothing was working. But I kept fighting. We fought a lot. And I shouldn't say this, but it's true. I pick fights sometimes. I know before I get home we're going to have a fight. Because I'm going to start the sumbitch. And the way I start a fight is I kind of ease into them. You get as much information from the other person as you need to win your argument. And then you can go frontally attack. So I walked in. I said, hi, darling. How are you doing? And she said, oh, I'm fine. She was cooking dinner. And I smelled the... Says, oh, dinner smells good. Yeah, thank you. Kids okay? Kids are fine. How's the dog? Dog is good. Dog is good. I said, Billy, I've been thinking. You think I'm an alcoholic. And she said, I don't know whether you are or not. I don't know whether you are or not. I don't know. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your mother thinks, your father thinks, the people at work think, what anybody in the world thinks except you. Because if you don't think you have a problem, you will never, ever do anything about it. Then I made a mistake. I asked a question when I didn't know the answer. No good trial lawyer does that. I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? And the jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. She said, well, the first woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous wrote a book. It's called The Primer on Alcoholism. Her name is Marty Mann. And she says in that book, there's a test that you can take to find out if you're an alcoholic or not. First of all, she says you can just quit. If you can quit and stay quit, you're not an alcoholic without some kind of help. And she said, I don't think you want to do that. I said, no, I don't want to do that. The second thing she said you could do is drink two drinks a day. Just two. Every day, Don't miss a day. Never exceed two drinks. And do that for 6 months. And if you can do that, you're not an alcoholic. And I said, just let me understand this, man. You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years. And now you want me to drink for 6 more months? She said, yeah. I said, that's the dumbest damn test I ever heard of in my life. And I left because this fight wasn't going anywhere where I wanted to go. I sat down in my chair and I thought about this thing. Now, I told you I was raised being responsible. And I carried that with me and have carried it with me all my life. I sat there in that chair and I'm thinking about it. Your family's about to fall apart. Your kids, you don't want to lose your kids. You've offered her the opportunity to leave the house and leave the kids with you, and she's turned that down more than once. Somebody's going to have to save this damn family. I guess, by God, it's going to have to be you. I'll take the damn test. I didn't tell anyone I'm going to take the test. But I knew she'd watch me. She'd count. So I decided I'll just take the damn test. I had to change the test a little bit. 2 drinks didn't do me any good at all. But I had a pretty good sized glass. And I figure I'll take 3 drinks. I'll drink 3 drinks a day. And nobody except a bunch of damn prohibitionists, which I think those Al-Anons are, would object to that. That's reasonable drinking. And if there's anybody here that thinks they've got no problem with alcohol, try some reasonable drinking. You can even set your own pattern as what's reasonable, and you'll flunk the damn test if you're an alcoholic. I decided I'd have 2 martinis. I switched to Beefeater's Gin because you're supposed to drink good stuff if you're drinking a lot. If you don't, it might mess up your head some way. I mean, don't want to do that. So I would have 2 Beefeater's martinis, which consisted of Beefeater's Gin over ice, sometimes just over nothing. And maybe you'd put an olive in there, you know, deep dish green olive pies. I like those. And you drink those 2 drinks, and then you'd eat dinner. After dinner, you could have a brandy. Had a big bottle, put a big glass of brandy and a little splash of soda in there, and for your digestion, and have that drink. Then switch to coffee. If you're going to drink anything else that night, it's going to be coffee, and there's not going to be any damned exceptions. You're going to do this every day for 6 months. Wouldn't have to do it 6 months. I knew that. She'd watch me and she'd see what he's just blowing that test away. And she'd get the hell out of Al-Anon because she'd recognize there's some serious risk to her going to those meetings. And I started taking the damn test. My recovery started there. My mind had been so messed up by alcohol and the value systems that I had developed while I was drinking that I didn't know the truth and the false about alcohol, certainly not. I was doing okay practicing law, I thought, but I was not doing well when it came to reasonable thinking about using alcohol. So I would sit down and I'd have 1 martini when I got home. Kind of let the strain of the day kind of slip off my shoulders, you know. Then I'd start on the 2nd martini. And there'd be a little bit left in the glass, and I'd think, well, it's about all the martinis today. And then I'd have a thought. And the thought would say, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports all these people in this damned house? Who goes down there and fights those other lawyers every day and them dumbass judges and those impossible clients? Who does that? Who's entitled to have a little relief and relaxation when he comes home? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? The answer was, hell no, I'm not going to. And I'd go to the bar and drink the damn bottle. And I'd wake up the next morning and I wonder, why did you do that? You flunked the damn test. She probably saw you. She didn't know you're taking the test, but she thought this situation normal. I'm just drinking like I always do. But I'm trying not to. I never thought about trying to limit the amount you drink. I don't know why anybody would want to do that, but that was what I was trying to do. And then the next night I might, you know, I'd rock along that way and flunk the test. And then one day I'd walk to the bar and had a bad day. And I'd walk up and I'd mix my first drink and I'd think, by God, there ain't going to be no test today. No test today. And I'd drink the bottle. Or I could even forget the damn test. Once in a while, I could just forget it. But my wife had a sponsor, a brutal woman. She taught her to do things that were just unconscionable. She had my wife, the minute she awakened in the morning, to say out loud, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, when you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, one eye's been propped open for about half the night and it's got a dry socket, I call it. Tongue is very thick. Heart's beating up in your head somewhere up here and pain is just blossoming ever beat. And you hear that. You're pretty damn sure you're not going to rejoice much that day. I gave that test a fair shot. I ran it a year and a half. Never passed her one time. Didn't get any walking drunk every night, I guess, but I just flunked it. And it destroyed me. Knowing I couldn't do that, I couldn't understand why. I had I'd been raised on a poor farm and worked my way through law school and I'd scuffed and scratched and fought like hell and had goals that I achieved and that I couldn't decide how much I could drink. A grown man couldn't decide he's going to drink three drinks and stay with it. I couldn't explain that. I could not explain that. And things kept happening, you know, little things that kind of you look back on and you wonder, how in the world did that happen? My firm required us all to go get an annual physical. And I went in 1971, I guess it was. The doctor did a bunch of tests, and he came in. And he said, "Jerry, it was the same doctor that I'd been to. I had what they call a gastritis in my stomach. My stomach was bleeding for unknown causes." And he said, "Sometimes it's caused by alcohol consumption and not eating." Well, that wasn't my case, of course, but that's... He knew a little about me and he sat me down and he said, "You're flunking this test. This liver test is not well, not good. You got to do something about this. You got to cut way back on that use of alcohol." Yeah. And I left, never thought another thing about it till the next year, November, somewhere in 1972. I went in, we took the test again and he called me into his room, sat down, said, "Jerry, I've got to talk to you." I said, "Look, I'm going to show you now. Here's the test. Your liver enzyme test is off the chart. You're in serious trouble with your liver. And I want you not to drink anything for 10 days and come back and we'll repeat this test." I got up and left, and I knew when I walked out of the office, I'm never going to see that doctor again. Because if I go back and I'm better, he said, "Oh, we found the cause." If I'm the same, you think he's going to recommend that I drink? No, not with the liver. So I just didn't go back. I can't imagine why in the hell anybody would do that. But I did. And on December the 31st, 1972, I was home. I didn't have any pressure. I didn't have anybody I was mad at. No active resentments that I can remember now. The only thing we were going to do, we were going to go out that night with a few of our friends, a couple of couples, and we're going to go out and eat dinner, and then we're going to come home to my house and bring in the new year. Now, I know why we're going to come back to my house, because already that month, one time I had got out and it was hard to get me home again. So they decided that they would bring me in while I was reasonably sober and we'd bring the new year in. So I started December the 31st with a goal in mind. I'm going to bring in the new year. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be sober enough that it won't bother anybody. Mixed my first drink in the morning. It's just kind of a festive occasion, and just thought a little nip might help. And my wife walked through and said, "Jerry, remember?" I said, I know, we're going out tonight. I got it. She said, "Okay." So I paced myself carefully through the day. And then I woke up and looked out the window. I was in my green chair, and I looked out the window, and it was pitch dark outside. And Billy was sitting over in her little rocking chair reading little books. They read lots of little books. They leave little books around for you to read too, but I never read one of the damn things. And I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go to dinner?" She said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" I looked at the clock, and it was about 10:15. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had no excuse for that. I wasn't mad. It wasn't any kind of a party going on. It was just me and a bottle. And I had passed out, and I knew that she had called those folks and said, "We can't go to dinner." And being a good Al-Anon, she probably said, "Because Jerry's passed out in his chair." But I can't say that for sure. But she also told him, "You can't come to our house this evening." And I knew all of that in the moment that I awakened. And I went to the bar and mixed myself a big drink because I wanted oblivion. And I got it. And I woke up on January the 1st of 1973. I had no place to go. I didn't know what the hell to do. I tried to control my drinking. I couldn't understand why I couldn't control my drinking. It was obviously ruining everything in my life. It was the sorriest looking day I believe I ever saw. I was at a bottom. The book tells us that hardly anybody can change their life except they go through reaching a bottom. We all reach bottoms at different places under different circumstances, but you reach a point where you know the resources you have will not solve the problem that you're looking at. It's the only time in your life when you can change the way you think, because that part of your brain that always told you what you need to make you happy, what you needed to accomplish, what you need to be successful, it's obviously not working. And what you have now is a place where you've got to stop and look and say, "What the hell is going on?" And I couldn't think. I was asking myself, "What are my options? What options do I have?" And the only one I could think of was to stop drinking. Something I did not want to do. Something I had promised everybody that ever talked. They'd been talking to me a long time about stopping drinking. All kinds of people. And I'd brushed them off, and, you know, if you talk to me about drinking, you better be willing for me to talk about the worst thing I know about you, because it's going to get nasty in just a little bit here. And I sat there that morning, though, and I was defenseless. I took a shower and went out to the kitchen and told Billy, "I'm real sorry for messing up last night." She was not very receptive to my apology. I said, "I've decided I'm going to try to stop drinking." She turned around and looked at me and she said, "I am so glad. Would you like for me to have somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous come over?" And I said, "Hell no, I wouldn't want anybody." I got myself in this mess. I'm going to get myself out if anybody does it. And she picked up a couple little books and said, happened to be the 24-hour book and the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why she had them there, but she had them, and she got them, handed them to me, said, "You may find these helpful." And I threw them against the wall pretty close to where she was standing. And I said, "Now you keep those damn AAs and them Al-Anons the hell out of here. And you keep the kids away from me and the dog and everybody else, because this ain't going to be pretty." And she said something loving like, "You got it," and walked off. And I had it. I didn't know I had it, but I got it. God, I can't tell you about that period of time. That was a terrible period of my life. I don't know how y'all were, but I couldn't sleep. I don't know why you're supposed to stop doing something that's bad for you. It ought to get better, shouldn't it? Wasn't working in my house. And I got quick. And I was always in the wrong place. If I'm sitting down, I ought to be standing up. If I'm standing up, I ought to be walking. If I'm walking, I ought to be outside. If I'm outside walking, I ought to be inside laying down. I'm just moving and grooving. And I'm quick. And I'm sweating. God, I'm sweating. It's January and Texas is cold. And I sweat's pouring off of me, and I got the yippies going all around here, you know. And whew. So at the end of the second day, I decided it. She was in the back of the house, and I decided I could sneak in the kitchen where I was pretty sure those books were. See what you AA and A folks did about this kind of problem. And I went in there, and I looked at the little 24. I'm sorry I didn't read conference-approved literature. Just didn't know about conference-approved literature. Wouldn't have done it if I had known about it, because I wanted something quick. And I grabbed the little 24-hour day back book, and with that keen alcoholic mind of mine, I opened it up and saw there was a date on each page. It went to January the 2nd, and it says, "Alcohol has ruined your life." And I said, "Hell yes." Hell yes. And it then went on to say, "This year we're going to give our drinking problem to God and leave it there." I cannot tell you how disappointed I was in that advice. I've been looking for God ever since I was a little kid. I heard the preachers talk about God. They talked about walking on water. They talked about all these wonderful things that happened. Bushes catching on fire. Things happening all around. And I wanted to see some of those things, but they could never produce them. And I developed a cross-examination skill very early. I asked questions that they didn't want to talk about. What was God standing on when he made the earth? They won't talk to They won't talk to you about that. They just won't. And I don't know why. I don't know why I did what I did next. I have no idea. But I threw that little book out in the middle of the table. And I think I closed my eyes. And I said, "God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you." A genuine prayer. I was in deep trouble. Knew I was in deep trouble. And do you know that nothing got any better. I felt just as bad, wanted to drink just as bad after that prayer as before it. Got up the next morning and with something that I hadn't had before. And that was some knowledge. Don't know where it came from. But I knew with absolute certainty if I didn't get some help today, I would drink. And I needed help with skin on it. I didn't need some mystical figure. So I needed a person. And the only people I knew were Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I couldn't go to where my wife went to this group, because she'd poisoned the well there. She had told them all. So I got the telephone going down, and there's all kinds of damn AA places in the telephone book. One of them was called the Intergroup. And that sounded to me like that might be headquarters for Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called them up, and I can't tell you, I haven't got anything against women at all. But I got one of them, one of the most unsympathetic women on the telephone you've ever heard in your life. I said, I'm having a little trouble stopping drinking. She said, who is this? I said, my name is, my name is Jerry. She said, okay, Jerry, you're having a little trouble stopping drinking. Have you been to any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous? No, I haven't. You need to go to a meeting every night, Jerry. I said, you don't understand. I'm a pretty big time lawyer, and I haven't got time to go to a damn meeting every night. She said, well, what have you been doing in the evening? I said, well, I've been drinking. She said, well, you're going to stop that, so you're going to have some free time, aren't you? So, we finally got around to picking me a little home group. I told her I wanted one near a country club that had only college graduates for members. She said, we ain't got none of them. So I said, give me, what do you got? What do you got? So she gave me the town and country group. Sounded kind of woodsy, you know. I thought they probably came to work in station wagons or something, you know. And anyway, I went to that thing, and it's kind of interesting. There were only about 8 people there, and they all had years of sobriety. They talked about all those years, 15, 20, 25 years. Their baby had a year and a half. I was working on maybe a week and a half, but no more than that. And his sponsor had 5 years, and I couldn't really believe those people ever had my kind of problem drinking. But I went once a week for maybe 3 weeks, and then one night an old boy walked in and got out of a treatment center up in South Dakota, I think it was. He had a litter tear sticking out of every pocket. He had railroad tracks across his nose and down his cheeks, and he was still quick. He had been in treatment for 4 months because something about him refusing to do a 4th step. But God, he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I ever saw. And he had 4 months of sobriety. 4. I listened carefully to him because that's the range of thought. I might do that. He walked out of the meeting afterwards, and I followed him out there, and I said, you know, what do you think about this AA thing we got here? He said, oh, this is not for us. I said, we need to go to a meeting every night. These people they're just going for maintenance, and they like each other. So we need to go and get sponsors. We need to do the steps. We're going to have to change the way we think. We're going to have to change everything about ourselves. We're going to have to make coffee. I don't know what the hell making coffee had to do with it, but he said we had to make coffee. Okay. And I said, where are we going to go? And he said, well, I heard of another place. He'd just come into town. Heard of another place that was just opening up way out in North Dallas. We could go out there. I'm going out there tomorrow night. Would you go with me? I said, I'll think about it. He said, well, sure would like for you to go. And he told me where it was and everything. So I said, I'll give it serious consideration. But I had to case the place like I was going to rob it. Next day I got in my car and drove by it. First time I drove past it, I was driving about 45, 50 miles an hour, and I just looked at it, you know. Made the block and came back, and it was over the top of a 7-Eleven store, convenience store. And I pulled in and parked and went in and bought a Slurpee or whatever the hell you buy in for throwaways in a 7-Eleven. Checked it was upstairs, and I kept checking for whether there were cameras or spies up there watching the street. Didn't see anybody either time. And I got in my car and I drove around to the back. There was a alleyway that went around beside the building and behind the place. And there it was. There were 6 parking places in the alley. I could go to that damn meeting, park in the alley, climb the fire escape, and go to an AA meeting without anybody seeing. And that's the way you got me. That's the kind of thinking that was going on in my head when I got here. I didn't like what you did here. People grabbed me and hugged me, and I did not want to be hugged by anybody. People, you know, were just drinking coffee like there was absolutely a shortage of the stuff in the world or something. Kind of, I didn't want any damn coffee. I came in right at the end of the meeting, and they told things about themselves that nobody, no sane human being will tell a group of people some of the things they ever did. It was just pathetic. And every time they told something really bad, everybody in the room just laughed like hell. Well, I'm competitive if I'm not anything else, by God. And I got to thinking, well, I did a couple of things that were kind of cute. I might tell them. And I did. And they put their arms around me and said, looky here, Jerry's beginning to open up. He's beginning to be himself. And that's all he can be. That's all you are. You're right there in your chairs right now, just like I was. You're all you will ever be. There's parts of you, there's things about you that you can change, like the way you think. And that will cause you to appear to be a different person. But there's a part of you you can't screw up. It's just as pure and just as good as the day you were born, and it's with you and it'll work for you as you're in this program. They told me that being myself and living inside my values, which are good values, was the greatest freedom I would ever know. So I started going to the damn meetings. And I began to like them. And finally I just told them, I said, I got to tell you something. I waited for the God Squad to come. I knew the God Squad was going to come because they were going to give this drinking problem to God. I knew that from that little book I'd read, you know. God Squad's going to get here in a minute and tell me what I got to believe, what I got to do. But he didn't come. So finally, they smoked me out. I went up and told one of them, I said, I don't have any faith. I'm not sure that I believe in God at all. And he looked at me and he said, well, okay. He said, we don't give a damn whether you got faith or not. We don't care what you believe. I said, really? He said, that's right. We don't care. What we want you to do is do what it tells the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells you to do and take those steps. And we're going to tell you, if you do that, what's going to happen? That'll be your proof that something's working in your life. If you do, whether you believe it or not, we don't care. Whether you have faith or not, don't matter. Just by God, do it. And we'll see what happens. He said, you will have a spiritual awakening if you do that. So I decided I'd try it. I sent a copy of the big book to my mother and father and told them that I knew I was a disappointment to them. They had told me I was ruining my life and the life of my family and children. And I said, this is the way I'm going to try to live my life from here on out. Mom read that book to Dad. Dad's eyesight was gone by then. And they thought Alcoholics Anonymous the best thing since sliced bread. I did those damn steps best I could. I tried to start thinking of a new way about my family. And we got invited out to we didn't get invited. My wife found there was some kind of little retreat out in East Texas. And she thought it would be good to see if we could help or put our family back together. We went out there. And there weren't any AA people there. Or Al-Anons. They were just civilians. Husbands and wives. Must have been 10 of them, you know, 10 couples. And after it was a Baptist retreat. I'm a Methodist if I'm anything. This Baptist thing was a real big step for me. Anyway, we finished the meal and sat down in a little room on the floor. And the minister stood out in the middle of the room and said, let's just go around and get this thing started off right. Pointed to a lady across the way and said, let's just tell me what God's doing for you in your life today. Well, hell, that's a testimonial. Methodists don't do testimonials. Baptists do testimonials and maybe some others, but Methodists don't. And I'm not going to do that. And I would have left, except I'm sitting on the floor and I'm going to have to crawl across the floor to get out the door. And I know my wife, Billy, is not going to go with me. She's going to stay right where she is. So I sat there and I figure somebody, just like AA, somebody will pass. Surely somebody will pass. And they started around that room and they were just pathetic. They were talking about little wimpy problems. Couldn't raise their children without God. What do you mean? I'm a good parent and I haven't had any God. Couldn't drive Central Expressway in Dallas without God. I've driven Central Expressway drunker and Cooter Brown for 10 years. Nothing problems. And I got to thinking, you know, if I told them that I was an alcoholic and had been sober for 3 months, I guess God's doing that. Somebody is. I couldn't stop before. What if I told these people that? I'd blow the socks off these Baptists. They'd probably want me to counsel with them after the meeting. So I looked around the room real carefully to be sure I wouldn't ever see any, or didn't think I'd ever see any of those folks again, and I decided, to hell with it, I'll just tell them. I didn't hear anything for a long time now because I'm making my speech up in my head. Nobody ever did that but me, but I get lost thinking about what I'm going to say when it's my time. Excuse me. And it came around to me, and there was an old young lady sitting next to me, and there was a big old boy sitting next to her. And he got up, and I tell you what, it was one of the most embarrassing displays I've ever seen. Most display of manhood. Was no manhood involved. He bawled. He squalled. He was about 6'4", weighed about 250 pounds, had calluses on the back of his hands where they drug the ground. You know that kind of guy? And he's up there bubbling and blowing his nose, and it's just pathetic. And then I figured out this little girl here must be his wife. And I began to feel really sorry for her. Finally, he sat down. And she stood up. And she said, I couldn't do it without God. He sustains me every day. He's the principal force in my life. The nicest thing about God is he's always available to every person. My children are ages 2 and 3, and someday they'll have an opportunity to know God. I'm not going to be there to help them, but someone will help them find God. And my husband, you saw him, he's having a terrible time with this. But he'll find someone else to help him raise those kids. And his life will be good and full, even though I'm not there. And I began to realize I'm listening to a 32-year-old woman who's got bad cancer. She's dying in just a little while. And the speech went out of my mind. And instead of that, I began to think, she has an incurable disease. It's called cancer. I have one called alcoholism. But my God, if she had my program, she could do my program and cure cancer, and they wanted to take off both of her legs, she'd said, I'll take it, just like that. And I'd been feeling real sorry for myself for being an alcoholic and have to give up drinking. And God talked to me then. I didn't know God talked like this, but he said, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? All you got to do the rest of your life is go to those meetings, live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can go anywhere and do anything that I ever intended for you to do. I didn't make a talk that night. I don't remember how I got out of that room. But I remember being out in the woods, tears streaming. I made that old boy sitting down. He looked like a real he-man compared to the way I was bawling. And I wasn't crying because I'm sorry for myself. I've had a sudden shift of consciousness from self-pity and ego to gratitude. Gratitude. I'm so happy to be in Alcoholics Anonymous and have a way out of this problem that I've got. My God, what have I been thinking about? And my life has gone on that way. I've had over and over, I've had those big shifts from self-consciousness, self-centeredness to a conscious contact with God. Went back to those AA meetings. Had some problems still. I was not unmanageable. My life was not unmanageable. I'd done pretty damn well. I got a promotion every year. Was making more money every year. Was one of the best drunk or sober trial lawyers in Dallas, the way I thought. But I was having trouble with that, and I did not understand self-centeredness at all. So I was sitting in this meeting one night, and they were talking about these subjects: self-centeredness and unmanageability. And I'm just half listening because it doesn't have anything to do with me. And then I remembered my goldfish bowl, my aquarium. When I was drinking, I got bored watching television. And one day I was in a pet shop and I saw an aquarium, had pretty fish in there, and I wanted those fish. I wanted that aquarium. So I bought it. It was my aquarium. I put it between my chair and the wall. I put the kind of gravel in it that I wanted. Put the kind of pretty flowers that I wanted in there. They kind of reached up to the surface. I put the kind of fish I wanted in there. Pretty, slow-swimming fish. Of course, you have to put some other kinds of fish in there to kind of clean the bowl and that sort of thing from time to time. So I had some of those. And I had a light on it. I could make it daylight or I could make it dark. I fed my fish if they were to be fed. Sometimes it was a land of plenty. Sometimes there was a famine upon the land. And that night I was sitting there in that meeting and I thought, you know, there was always some disruption in that bowl. I just get to watching the pretty fish and one of those bowl cleaners or something would come up and begin to nip the tail of one of the pretty fish. And he'd begin to swim faster, and he'd encounter other fish, and the first thing you know, the whole damn bowl was just going back and forth. Just drove me crazy. And I'd reach out and I'd slap the side of that bowl like that, you know. Let them know there's a power greater than they are that's out there that pissed off. I gave him three claps of thunder. You know, any self-respecting fish would learn in that period of time. But there are such unfortunates, they seem to be born that way. I got in my little dip net, and I'd take the offending fish out, put my hand on the top of the deal and have a drink, and put some hands-on experience with him so he'd know who the power was. And I think about people out there that I'd like to get my dip nets on. You know, I had several of those folks I could snatch out of the water. And then I'd put them back. Now, timing is really important here. The best I can tell you is if they float, you kept them out too long. Lots of them I get back in time. And so I gave them three claps of thunder. Three dip net treatments, and then, you know, you reach a point where you just can't go any further. So the fourth time I got my dip net on them, I'd just take them out and flush them down the toilet and go buy another one that may be smarter. And that night, sitting in that meeting, it occurred to me, you know, there's not a lot of 41-year-old lawyers in big firms that are sitting around getting offended by what fish are doing in a fishbowl. That might be considered self-centeredness. There's not a lot of people punishing fish in Dallas, probably. And, you know, you've been talking about unmanageability, and hell, you can't even run a fishbowl. And those insights kept coming to me. All the truths that are contained in our literature, all the truths that you hear in meetings, all the experience that people have had that have turned their lives around. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it takes you to places you've never been. I was an angry, angry man when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A few years after I'd been in, I was in Colorado fishing, went into a tackle shop, Saw an old boy over there that I'd been on the board of a church with, had gone hunting with him. He looked at me kind of funny and said, "Aren't you Jerry Jones?" I said, "Well, hell yes, Bill." He said, "What happened to you?" And I said, "Well, I've got a few more miles on me and a couple of dings, but, you know, not much, I guess." And he said, "Oh, no, something's happened to you. You're not angry anymore. Tell me what happened to you." And he wouldn't leave me alone until I told him about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never spent one day working on anger in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I spent my day doing was trying to bring myself into live the values that are taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to be of service, trying to be kind and considerate and loving to people around me, whether I really identified with them closely or not. But the fact was, I changed the way I was thinking. It didn't happen in a week, a day, a month. It happened slowly over time, and I kept having these wonderful experiences like that one to know that something's working in my life. People stopped me on the street and said, "We don't know what the hell you're doing, but whatever it is, keep doing it, because you look better than ever." And I've been doing that for a long time now. This program has taken me through a lot of hurdles in life. I lost my mother and my father both. Something we all do, most of us do. It's not a pleasant thing to have happen. My mother told me, the family in my life, well, the first time she got cancer, went for an operation, and I wasn't going to drink, but I got drunk when they told me that she probably wasn't going to live a year. She was in a recovery room, and she got out, and I was drunk for 2 or 3 days around there, and it was no use to anybody, and they sent me home. A few years later, after I'd been in AA for a while, she called me and asked me if I'd come up. She's going to have another surgery. She said, "I thought it was cured, but it seems like they found another lump in my stomach." And I went up there, and we talked, and it was easy and comfortable. She said, "Jerry, get the family in here. I want to talk to them." So I brought everybody in, and she said, "Folks, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I've been fighting this cancer for about 17 years, and I don't know whether I'm weaker now than I've ever been. And I don't know whether I'm going to make it this time or not. I'm going to try. I'm going to give it a best shot I got, but I don't know how it's going to be. It's going to be hard on me. It's going to be hard on you. But Jerry here will be your strength. Lean on him." Prophetically, my father, the day she died, after 2 or 3 horrible weeks, blew a big ulcer in his stomach, and they had to take most of his stomach out. He couldn't go to the funeral. And all the stuff you do at that time kind of fell on me. And I did an okay job. And after it was all over, I thought one day, you know, while all that was going on, never one moment did I think about taking a drink. It never even crossed my mind. People ask me today, "Does it bother you that we're drinking around you?" And I said, no. I'm just so damn glad I don't have to do it. God, I'm just so glad I don't have to do that anymore. I don't miss it. I don't want it. I'm just so happy I don't have to do that. And that's been the story with me. My dad, we got our difficulties ironed out in the last 2 minutes of his life. He asked me how long he's going to live, and I said, "I don't know, Dad." He had an aorta rupture. Yeah. He said, "Well, Jerry, I want you to know it's been pretty good." Stuck his hand out and we shook hands, and he died. He never said, "Love you," but that was good enough. I knew that's what he meant. I've had all kinds of things come to me, good things and bad things, deaths. I have cancer. I got leukemia a little while after I retired. And I worried a lot about this whole thing. I thought I went through the whole God routine again, thinking about where am I going to go after I die? When am I going to die? How am I going to die? What's it going to be like to go through that last illness? And then I got prostate cancer, and they had to do an operation on me for that. And this same thoughts were rolling around from time to time. And one day I said, "You know what? I'm not going to screw up another good day thinking about this. whatever comes by God is just going to come, and there ain't a damn thing I can do about it except do what the doctors tell me to do and rock on. And I've been doing that for quite a while now. And I don't feel the least bit sorry for myself. I've been given more in this life than I could have ever asked for. Life has been good. My thought processes have changed. I have a different purpose on life than I ever had before. I'm not trying, I finished up my law career and I wasn't trying to make money. I was trying to be of service. I was trying to be a good partner to my partners. I was trying to help my clients. And just that change in attitude adjustment, a second meaning of Alcoholics Anonymous, had worked in my life. And it was done because I processed my life through those steps. And I don't think you can get it any other way. I think you've got to have that bottom, and then you've got to work yourself up and through that and change the way you think and the way you act. We have a tremendous problem in this world today with alcoholism and drugs. It's absolutely epidemic. Bill Wilson, Lois Wilson was on her last illness in New York. And she was in the critical care unit. And the manager of the general service office knew that she was about to die. And so he thought, well, you know, I need to go see her and thank her for what she's done for Alcoholics Anonymous. So he went to see her, and she had tubes in her mouth and she couldn't talk. She had a little pad that she could write little questions on. And he visited with her for a little bit, and he said, Lois, I came here today to thank you for saving our lives, what you did. You and Bill and Bob and Ann Smith, you really did a wonderful thing for us, and you saved our lives. She grabbed her little pad and wrote, not me, God. He said, oh, you got me. You got me, Lois. Of course, that's right. But Lois, you were his representative. And she wrote, and so are you. And so are you. If we're going to fight this thing, if we're going to help people out there, that we've been helped, it's our job to go get them. Hunt drunks. Don't worry about screwing them up. They're already screwed up. Get them in a meeting. Don't try to fix them up on your own out there somewhere. Bring them in, warts and all, and let the magic process take place. Thank you so much for having me.